There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Connecting to the big show.
In three, two, one.
The return boat voice claims nobody ever bought a pair of pillows and cycled home with them on the handlebars.
We're going to come together. We want our voices heard. We want that station manned.
There's only so many hits and kicks you can take when you're in business, whether you're a hairdresser or a restaurant.
Join the conversation.
Call 0818 96 96 96.
Text or WhatsApp 083 396 96 96.
Email opinion at 96FM.com.
This is the Opinion Line with PJ Coogan.
Coach 96 FM.
There was so much to do. We had fun last Friday. I just threw it out there, mad, at about 11:15. You know, if I had a bunch of box sets to give out, what one would you like? I don't, by the way. There are no box sets. There are no prizes. But the best television show you can remember from your childhood, from your youth, I'd give you the box set if you tell me what it is. I don't have box sets, but you know yourself. We'd say we'll have a bit more fun with that after 11 o'clock this morning. You wouldn't believe the stuff we have dredged out of the archives, but you get your name in there. 083 396 96 96. If I could give you a magic box set, the show I would give you on box set. What would it be? All right? That's all to come. All to come. It's Friday. The weather is a bit iffy. But then again, Alan from Carlow Weather has been saying that the weather is a bit iffy this weekend and a bit iffy into the early days of next week, but things look hectic enough, look handy enough, rather, for the May bank holiday, which is important. All right. Morning to you. Friday, 0818 96 96 96, the number. The text or WhatsApp, 083 396 96 96. The email is opinion at 96fm.ie. We'll look shortly at the latest in that investigation into the crash on the 11th of February in which my friend and Fergal's Sheila Dunn died. We'll delve further into the investigation into that in a wee while. But first, you'll remember that last week, Minister for Justice Helen McEntee spent nearly an hour here in studio with me, well, over half an hour anyway, and I was able to put to her a few of the things that bother you, particularly in terms of policing and the absence of guards. And one of the things that came up in the course of our conversation was Carrigaline and just how bereft of guards Carrigaline is these days. Now, we touched on the topic of kids breaking into cars and robbing stuff out of cars. And here's what the minister had to say when I brought it up to her about the fact that Carrigaline is almost lawless. Sure, the guard at the station in Carrigaline might as well be an ornament. There's no one there. The nearest guard is in Toker. Youngsters are robbing cars with impunity in Carrigaline every night of the week because there's no guard there and they know it.
Well, people might want to hear it, but the overall figure for burglaries in Cork is down. That's not to say, and that's not to diminish anybody who's had something robbed. I'm not for a second, but I'm just saying they are the
facts.
But
why do you keep referring back to a number rather than people's lived experience, Minister? Numbers are up on a page and they look lovely, but people's lived experience that they're filling my programs with. One of the reasons the numbers are down, Minister, is for something like having money or something robbed out the back of your car. They don't even bother reporting it now. People don't even bother reporting these crimes because they know that the guards are powerless because A, there's so few of them, and B, the guys are long gone.
I would encourage anybody who's a victim of a crime to report it.
Now, that's to do with car theft and interference with cars in Carrigaline, which is at epidemic proportions, and we know that. But, Michael, your story is more serious. What happened to your daughter last weekend? Good morning.
Yeah, good day there, PJ. Yeah, it's Mick, not Michael. Even my mother doesn't call me Michael. No, PJ, my daughter was out for a walk with friends.
Oh, I remember you. Hold on, now that I have the voice, I remember you from the late Norian crew.
That's the one.
Tell me the story, fella.
Yeah, well, my daughter, she was out for a walk with friends of hers. So they walked down to Carrigaline. They got down there to the bus stop near the bridge in the main street at about 10:30 Saturday night. Now, she was meeting up with her boyfriend to get the bus back home. And there was two young fellas messing about at the bus stop. So they went to walk past them to get to the other end, just to avoid them, and they turned and jumped on them. Now, it turned out they kicked the boyfriend in the head. He was on the ground. My daughter went to try and help him. They ended up being thrown against the wall and then kicked, knelt on, and practically strangled. Now, they were able to beat them off, and the two attackers basically left.
This now, is the bus stop arrived. Now by the bridge, Michael. A very busy bus
just
stop.
Just on the main street.
By the chemist by Simon Colby's office.
That's right, yeah. Everyone in Carrigaline has used that bus stop.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there was people on the other side of the bridge at the other bus stop waiting to go to town. But the two attackers, yeah, they left. Now, the guards arrived down because they'd been notified of these two basically fighting each other. As they arrived back, the two attackers arrived back over the bridge, and one of them was armed. Now, they arrested one of them, the other one ran off. Yeah. Now, both of them are known to the Gardaí.
Okay.
Now, the one who was arrested, he was back walking the streets of Carrigaline the following morning.
Yeah. How was your daughter?
Now, she's been able to get some sleep there since Monday, but she was in agony all last week. Yeah. Now, the first I heard about it was Saturday night, 12 o'clock. My daughter rings me, asked me to take her to A&E because they were in so much pain, herself and the boyfriend.
Oh, God.
So I took them out there. They were out there till 10 o'clock Sunday morning, and turned out she had a hairline fracture of the rib, severe bruising, damage to her back. He had bruised ribs, damage to his rotator cuff in his shoulder. But it's just the sort of phone call no parent wants to get.
Ain't that the truth,
when
man?
Something happens to your child, especially when they're not doing anything wrong. Now, saying that, PJ, the guards, I know for a fact, it was on one of your news programs last week, they're 120 guards short to man the 12-hour shifts.
Yeah, it was. I put it to the Minister of Justice several times when she was in with me last week. This is a figure given to me by the Garda Representative Association. Patrick Harrington is their local rep, and he gave me that figure late last year, that at any one time in Cork, they're 120 guards short.
Yeah. Now, even the guards, when they were there, they offered to take them to the hospital, but at that stage, they just wanted to get home. But it was only, I think, when the adrenaline sort of ran out, they started feeling the pain.
Yeah.
Now, the guards have been keeping in contact. But, yeah, it's just the fact that my daughter had to move out of Carrigaline for a week because she was getting threats from these two offenders, friends, family. Now, she's a smart kid. She was taking screenshots of every threat that came through.
Hold on. The guys who attacked them Saturday night, not content with that, they then started threatening her.
Well, friends of theirs, one of the attackers turned up outside the boyfriend's house. Yeah, he lives in another part of Cork, and wanted to apologise.
Right.
Now, this is just a case of hoping that they're not going to go forward, but my daughter's determined to see this through.
Good for her.
But it's just simple things that, I mean, I in no way advocate sort of reprisals or anything like that. Sure, you know yourself, PJ, you hear from mates in the pub, oh, you know, we'll sort them out and all this type of thing. But no, an eye for an eye, fair enough.
That just makes things worse.
The right process. Yeah. You go through the legal process to get the justice. But it's simple things like, you know yourself, that Owner Boy car park, that green area.
Yeah.
At the very front, just behind the bus stop. If you go through there on a Sunday morning, the amount of alcoholic containers left there from the previous night. Mm. It's just ridiculous.
Mm.
And that's in the centre of the village. I mean, even adults are too scared to go through there every night time. And come the summertime, teenagers just take it over.
Yeah. Yeah, you had the thing with, and look, it's a fantastic bus service, and we all love having it there. But you have this thing with the 220 bus, that they're coming from other parts, particularly coming from Ballincollig, and setting up fights with each other at the two ends.
Yeah, we all heard about what happened, I think it was summer before last.
Yeah.
When there was all the weapons involved, like Hurleys, you name it, coming down on the bus.
That's right. That's right.
But it's even simple things like, I know the guards can't be down there all the time at the moment, but you hardly ever even see a guard car go through there at the night time over the weekend.
But there's the thing, Mick. As I put it to the minister when she was on the show last week, and I'm taking months and months worth of calls about thefts from cars and stuff as serious as yours. Crime in Carrigaline is, the locals will tell you, almost out of control. And one of the reasons is because that flipping Garda station might as well be an ornament.
No, you've only got to look at the Carrigaline Facebook page. Every single day there's people asking, does anyone know what time they're open?
Yeah.
Even to get simple paperwork stamps.
Yeah.
Never mind reporting crime.
But, like, if you went down there in the morning to report something, if you went down there now, it's 16 minutes past 9 on a Friday morning, if you went down there, is that place open?
No. So you don't know what time it's going to actually open. Mm. It changes almost every day.
And this isn't to blame. The guards aren't to blame here. The individual guards are not to blame. It's management's to blame.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the guards did. I mean, I have total confidence in the guards, so I can see them following this through. And the care they gave towards my daughter and her boyfriend,
yes.
I mean, couldn't be faulted.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just doing a hard job without the resources that they should have.
Yeah.
But I think one thing we do need, and I think the minister actually mentioned it, we need more proactive public involvement. Simple things like the people across the bridge. My daughter was screaming out for them to ring the guards.
Yeah.
And none of them, they just basically turned their back.
People don't get involved.
I do want to give one word of praise. A bus did arrive and was a female bus driver. She pulled in, opened the doors, let my daughter on, turned off the lights, locked the doors, and rang the guards.
Oh, well done her.
Yep. So my daughter actually sent a message in.
It's a 220 bus driver.
Yep. A female bus driver.
About what time last Saturday night, Mick?
It was Saturday before last. That would have been about 20 to 11.
Okay, about 20 to 11, and Saturday before last. A female bus driver on the 220 route came to the assistance of someone being beaten up at the side of the road, turned off the lights, locked the door and called the guards. Whoever you are, well done, whoever you are. And whoever your boss is, well done.
And she waited there until the guards arrived.
Well done. Well done.
I mean, it's people like that who actually do something, even if it's just a phone call to the guards. The guards can't act on things they don't know.
Yeah.
People are more content to just drive past. It's the same as if there's a traffic accident. Traffic slows down. People want to have a look.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think people they shouldn't be scared of ringing the guards. They don't have to leave their name. Just report the incident.
1-800-666-111.
Yeah.
Or just call 999.
I've got two other daughters who use that same bus stop. One coming home from school, one from work. It could be anybody's daughter, anybody's son, anybody's brother, sister, mother, father, grandparents. I mean, we just have to basically start looking out for each other.
Yes. And another 5 minutes, Mick, and things could have been even worse by the sounds of it.
Exactly. Yep.
If that bus driver hadn't come on the scene, things could have been worse.
That's it. So, I mean, I would urge anyone who has any footage as well of the incident, if they can hand that in to the guards.
Okay. You're determined, your daughter's determined to go through with this.
Oh, 100%.
Good for her.
And what about
her fella? Is he okay, a boyfriend?
Yeah, no, he's back at work. He had the bruised ribs, but he's going to have physiotherapy for the shoulder.
Right.
But again, he's a sound young fella.
Good. You make the point, you shouldn't have to deny your children their freedom just to keep them safe.
No, well, I always tell, I've got three daughters. And I tell them I trust them 100% to do the right thing. But it's the other people they don't know out on the street
who
can cause them trouble. And unfortunately, it was proved right.
You know, your accent tells me, and sure, I know you, another remember it from the late Norient days. Melbourne is where you come from originally. Tell me something. And my daughter's over there at the moment and loving the place, by the way. Loves your native city. And she tells me, Dad, there are cops everywhere. Like, this kind of crack wouldn't be tolerated in Melbourne.
No, there's always police over there. If you're a driver in Australia, doesn't matter which part. Now, I came from about an hour and a half north of Melbourne. The nearest town was 8 miles away. Mm. You would get pulled over, you would get breathalyzed, car would get checked at least once a week for every driver, no matter which road you're on.
Holy moly. Well, she was saying that she's driving to work and it's about 30, 40 minutes away from where she's living. And she said, Dad, I never saw so many guards, cops, day, night, middle of the night shift. She's doing night shifts. And she's been stopped on the way home from work.
Now, they'll close off whole freeways and they'll breathalyze every single driver.
And what about something like that now? Two innocent youngsters been beaten up at the side of the road.
Well, there's mobile cars on the road the whole time. They have the facial recognition software as well. It comes up straight away. They do the fingerprints there, and then if they catch them. But again, there's very quick response times because they have the resources. They have the amount of police in the place at the right time.
Yeah, and they come down like flies. They're everywhere. Yeah.
Now, I mean, it's a controversial point as well, but I mean, all the police in Australia, they're armed. And you have a look at that situation in the shopping centre in Bondi Junction.
Yeah.
If that female cop hadn't been there with her service weapon, who knows how many other people that fella would have stabbed.
Yeah. I hope she gets a medal.
Yep. I think she will.
I hope she gets a medal for that. You used to work, they're telling me here, Mick, and I'm sure many years ago you told me, you used to, you know, that we watch these programs, these border patrol programs. Used to do that gig.
Yeah, I was 9 years customs immigration officer at Melbourne Airport. So I see a lot of my old workmates are still popping up on the show every now and then.
Really? Yeah. And the stuff that comes in and out, like, I mean, you're watching, it's a television show and you know it's edited for effect, but like, some people are terrible fools thinking they can get stuff through.
Oh, you wouldn't believe some of the things you see come through.
Go on, tell me.
We had a situation there. It was New Year's morning. Now, we were all hungover and we had to do what we call unaccompanied baggage.
Right.
So it's bags that have gone missing and they arrive without the owner. So they all have to be searched. And there was a smell coming off two of these bags. And it was enough to turn the stomach, rotting meat. Okay. Turned out it was a whole goat. In
what?
The bag. It had been disemboweled. All the internal organs had been put in plastic bags back into the carcass. Apparently it was a wedding up in the Greek mountains. And this is a traditional wedding gift. So they gave it to the bride and groom and they packed it up and bringing it back to Melbourne. I guarantee you there were some green faces that morning.
Hang on. So somebody got a wedding gift of a dismembered goat.
Yep.
And tried to bring it back through customs. I was thinking you had a drug story or something.
No, there was a few of those, but can't really talk about them.
Okay, yeah. Oh, that's the best, yeah. Yeah, that didn't make Border Patrol, I'd say.
No, that was before the filming days. They started that after I left.
How long are you here now?
Well, first came over 32 years ago. Mm. Been living in Carrigaline for the last 26.
Right. Did you originally come with the intention of staying?
No, I came over on holidays, met a girl, still paying for that trip. Most expensive holiday on record, I think.
Yeah, now that I remember travelling over to Leighton Orient a couple of times and you were on that trip. Mick, I really please give my regards to your daughter and to her fella. And I hope everything will be okay. And I know if from the sounds of you and my memories of you, you ain't letting this go, pal.
No. Like I said, it could happen to somebody else. And that's the same reason my daughter is carrying through with this. She doesn't want to hear on the news that these two have murdered someone, whether it's by accident or deliberate.
Okay. All right, man.
And I just don't want anyone else to be going through this type of concern about one of your kids.
Okay. And if anybody else, come back to it, last Saturday night week, I'm trying to pull the date up off the top of my head now.
13th.
The 13th of April, around half past 10.
Correct.
The bus stop by the bridge.
Yep,
serious the incident. Street. Yeah, and whoever that bus driver was that stopped deserves.
Gosh, he's a legend.
Absolutely. All right. Take care, Mick. Thank you very much. 0818 96 96 96. Mick Giffney, originally from Melbourne, 20 odd years more actually in Carrigaline. 10:30 on the night of the 13th of April, his daughter and her boyfriend by the bus stop there at the bridge, beaten up by a couple of thugs. Following morning, one of those thugs is back on the street. Michael and his daughter are not letting this go. They're going to take it to the full extent. But you know what? It's further extent, further. Carrigaline, I lived there for 10 years. I loved it. I still love it. Still love Carrigaline. I have many friends in Carrigaline. It's gone to the flipping dogs. The place is gone to the dogs. My sister-in-law lives there. And the stories she tells you from when she's out walking her dog. Like, the place is gone to the dogs. Literally. 0818 96 96 96. Thank you, Mick, and my best to your daughter and her boyfriend.
Join the conversation.
This is the Opinion Line.
With the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
The Big Drive Home. With Izzy Showbizzy.
On Cork's 96 FM.
Join me weekdays from 4 p.m. where we could be sending you to Taylor Swift live in Wembley, VIP style. Plus, I'll be taking your requests on The Takeover.
Hi, we're listening to you in the car on the way to collect my sister. We're choosing the Ariana Grande song for the big drive home. Bye.
And we'll have more giveaways that will make you go like this.
Izzy, delighted. You just made my day.
Join me weekdays from 4 p.m.
The Big Drive Home.
You can drive me home.
With CityLink. Previously GoBus. Relaxing and reliable travel from Cork to Dublin and Dublin Airport. See citylink.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
96 FM.
By the way, I'll come back to this. Do you remember Lillian, who was on with me yesterday, paid her television license at the end of March and was surprised to get another letter? She hadn't paid it last year because she said she couldn't afford it, as many people couldn't. She got a letter now to say that she needs to pay again because that was a backdated payment. Never heard of such a thing. We'll come back to it. Fergal did some digging yesterday for us. Now, this story broke during the show yesterday morning. A woman arrested in connection with an accident that happened at Sarsfields Court on Sunday, February the 11th. That woman has been released without charge. Mairead Twigg is in the newsroom. Mairead, what's been happening over the past 24 hours?
That's it, PJ. So yeah, this came in through Garda Press yesterday morning, as you say, while the show was on. And word through that a woman had been arrested as part of the Garda investigation. And it's into that fatal road traffic collision in Glanmire over 2 months ago. As you say, it happened on Sunday, the 11th of February. And a woman who was in the vehicle involved died 2 days later at Cork University Hospital as a result of injuries sustained in that single vehicle collision. And as you mentioned earlier, Sheila Dunn was the lady who sadly passed away from Glanmire. You said yourself there that yourself and Fergal knew her very well, and she was originally from Newcastle West in County Limerick. As I say, she died from injuries sustained in that collision. Now, the woman was arrested and was taken for questioning at a Garda station in Cork. We weren't told which Garda station, but she was taken in. And then late last night, Garda Press came back with an update to say that the woman who was questioned as part of the ongoing Garda investigation was released without charge, but a file now is being sent to the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecutions, in connection with the collision as part of that investigation. As they say, it happened on the 11th of February, over 2 months ago, and that investigation has been ongoing, and the latest in that was that arrest was made yesterday. The woman released without charge, but the file is going to the DPP.
Okay, and we'll follow that with interest as it progresses. English has a lot of detail. Thank you, Mairead. Owen English has a lot of detail this morning in The Examiner. He recalls the accident which happened around 7:45 Sunday evening, the 11th of February, where a white SVU was found by the emergency services. It was lying on its side up near Sarsfields Court, lying on the driver's side. They found Sheila Dunn critically injured on the driver's side of the car. There was another woman in the car. Her injuries were not life-threatening. Sheila was taken to Cork University Hospital, where, unfortunately, she passed away 2 days later. The investigation began, as these things do. And what aroused suspicions, according to Owen's report in the Examiner this morning, was that an autopsy on Sheila's body found that certain injuries she suffered were not consistent with her being in the driver's seat. A previous report on this said it was to do with seat belt marks. But the seat belt marks on Sheila's body were not consistent with her being in the driver's seat. Now, you can imagine that aroused suspicion straight away. And since then, the guards have been trying to establish whether Sheila was moved into the driver's seat after the crash, who might have moved her, and why they would have done it. Now, he also cites a report from the Irish Times, which I went into this morning and looked at, that a forensic examination of the vehicle also found evidence of Sheila's DNA on the passenger airbag, which of course would have inflated on impact. So her DNA was in the passenger airbag, yet Sheila was found in the driver's seat. And as you can imagine, that raises quite a number of questions for the guards, and those questions are still being answered. They've spent many weeks now looking at CCTV from right along the route that the car took to trace vehicle movements. Owen is also reporting in this morning Examiner that they've been going through phone records to see if any of the occupants of the car contacted other people around the time or just after the crash. Now, there's no more detail in his report, but Fergal and I have been hearing this also over the last few weeks. It has chapters to be written yet, does this story. But once again, my thoughts, our thoughts, Fergal's and mine, and indeed anybody else at this building who knew the wonderful Sheila Dunn and her husband, late husband Ted. In fact, they had been marking Ted's anniversary the weekend that this tragedy happened. And my thoughts this morning with Lily and with TJ and with all the members of the family who are still going through this, because the questions are not answered. They have yet to be answered. And one hopes that in the fullness of time, those questions will be answered. Owen has a very comprehensive report on it in this morning's Examiner. Thank you for that, Owen.
Join the conversation.
This is the Opinion Line
with the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining, and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
Feels so good.
Derry O'Callaghan brings you the best music mix on Oldies and Irish.
Every Sunday from midday on Cork's 96 FM.
Welcome along to the programme. Great to have your company on a Sunday. As I say, it's a privilege. Hopefully you can join me.
Tune it up and take it easy with a big show on your radio.
It's the perfect Sunday soundtrack.
Feel so good.
Oldies and Irish with Derry O'Callaghan.
Every Sunday from midday to 2 p.m.
on Cork's 96 FM.
As I say, I'll come back to that piece of information we picked up about the television licence in a wee while. Something you might not have known. I certainly had no idea. But you have to backdate your television licence. Now, the Alcohol Forum of Ireland wants to regulate teenage discos, or wants to control teenage discos. Paula Leonard and I have spoken before about this. I would have been in a previous life, Paula, I'd probably have been the DJ at some of these teenage discos. So I'm kind of wondering what was so wrong with them, looking back now. But take it up from there. What is so wrong with teenage discos? Good morning.
Good morning. I think teenage discos are really important. I think they're great. I think they are a really important and fundamental rite of passage for teenagers in Ireland. And they have been that for a very long time. In fact, back to even the late 1970s. So, I'm a bit older, I suppose. But my experiences of teenage discos were of relatively small events. Do you know what I mean? Where there were people I knew, where there were probably older siblings or, you know, people keeping an eye on you, where you were being picked up by your parents, where you were being supervised possibly by volunteers or people in your local sports club or whoever was running the event. And I think those events at that time were very much run thinking about children, the recreational lives of children and what we wanted to see for our children and young people. They were a place where people were taking risks. There was alcohol involved on occasion. There was all of those things happening. But this is a question of scale and this is a question of regulation and children's rights and children, the protection of children. What we have had happened in this country in 2003, the law was changed, alcohol licensing law was changed, a small amendment at that time, so that children were allowed to be on a licensed premises where their parents weren't present. And it said, you know, that law was interpreted by the Gardaí at the time that that was up until 9 o'clock. The DPP the following year, and Michael McDougall was back then the Minister for Justice, disagreed with that interpretation. And, you know, the DPP's position was actually children can be on licensed premises, adult, you know, premises that are designed for adults, environments that are designed for adults. They can be there at any hour whatsoever, as long as alcohol isn't being sold. So that sort of opened the floodgates. And I think a really sad thing, and you were saying you were used to DJ yourself, and I think the thing is that what has happened since then is that nightclubs are on their knees. The nightclub scene in Ireland is in trouble. We have, you know, very few nightclubs left now in this country. But the upcoming proposals that change the alcohol licensing laws in this country, they're not going to save them. What they're proposing is that they'll open them till, you know, 5:30 you can serve alcohol and at 6, you know, 6 a.m. they can be open till.
Well, they're saying, Paula, that they can be. They're not saying that they will be.
Yeah. But feasibly, on a for-profit model is what these large-scale teenage events are now being run. Are feasibly we going to have children until those hours? So what we're just saying is simply, you need to tighten this up. You need to put in a few paragraphs into the intoxicating liquor bill that deal with teenage discos. You need to say, what's the youngest age that somebody can be at them?
Because there's a thing. Nightclubs. The nightclubs of Cork, the few that are left. And to be fair, when there were many more, I was working in most of them. Nobody that goes to a teenage disco would get inside the door of them.
No, but these exactly. And I mean, I suppose in my day, we were in adult nightclubs, probably underage, and that probably wasn't right either. Do you know what I mean? At 16, 17. But what we are seeing, and we have carried out research, and Dr. Grainne Kettler from the ATU worked with me on this report, did talk to young people, did talk to, you know, frontline service providers. She talked to sexual assault treatment units. She talked to the Gardaí. She talked to people involved in the trade and the running of these. She talked to parents. And what people are very concerned about is we don't have a lower age limit. You know, because so at the moment, you could have up to 2,000, 2,500 young people at these events. You could have 11-year-olds in the same premises socializing and mixing with 2,500 other young people with very light touch supervision. With teenagers up to 17 years of age, feasibly. So we're not saying that's happening all the time, but why would we not have a guideline on it? We have guidelines for childcare providers. We have them for schools. We have them for health settings. We have them for youth work settings. We have them for the local GAA club. We have them for the local soccer club, karate club, swimming, whatever it is. We have adult to child ratios.
The organisers would need to keep the kids safe. One thing that you'll never change,
absolutely,
I suspect, Paula, because it was happening in my time and it's happening now, even though they didn't have a name for it in my time, prinking. You can't stop them filling up with booze before they come to the event, no matter, even if all you're serving there is water. You can't stop them filling up with booze.
I suppose the care and the protection of children is everybody's responsibility. So it starts with parents, it runs to schools, it runs to, you know, youth work services, it runs to the people who run the buses to these events, it runs to the guards. In terms of, you know, if children are turned away from being intoxicated, they're out on the street at risk, it runs to the venues. What we're simply saying is build those child protection safeguards into the law and demand that there are some sort of guidelines around these. Unfortunately, we've had reports, and there have been prosecutions, you know, reported where young girls have not got in to these nightclubs because they're intoxicated, they've been turned away. So the nightclub venue is saying, well, they're not our responsibility, they're drunk and we're not serving alcohol in here, it's too much trouble. Those young people then came on a bus, travelled, you know, long distances to get there, they're wandering around the streets, highly intoxicated. And we have had some serious sexual assaults on young people who have not been able to gain entry. So, you know...
How do you stop that from happening, Paula?
So, you know, you introduce safety guidelines. You ask premises that are running these to have a child safeguarding policy, to have a, you know, to have a child safeguarding statement for how they're going to manage it. So some venues have really good practice. Some venues have a safe area, a room allocated where there are, you know, adults present. If somebody shows up intoxicated, they're not allowed into the venue, but they're allowed into this room. Parents are rang. If parents can't be got, guards are rang, and there are safety measures. But those are the good practices. Why would we not have those as very named, cleared guidelines?
And do you want to legislate for those practices? Say that if I take over my local GAA pavilion for a teenage disco, that I would need to provide something like a dressing room where there would be adults in charge in case anyone arrives drunk?
Absolutely. Or somebody, you know, like children are getting separated from their friends. Because friends are getting in and somebody is rambling about, you know, very intoxicated in the line, and they're not. So, I mean, at the moment, I think some nightclubs are saying, well, I'm not letting them in because I'm not supposed to be serving alcohol. You know, I'm not supposed to have intoxicated children on my premises. But they still should have a clearly mandated and legislated for responsibility for those children. Because the care and the safety of children in this country is everyone's responsibility.
Indeed.
That's what the child protection legislation is about.
Have you spoken to, say, the likes of Tusla about this?
Yeah, we have. But I think the thing that really shocked me, I suppose, in looking at and writing this report is that we did a deep dive and a root and branch review of policy in Ireland. So we've had research in Ireland that said since 1984, these have been one of the two most popular activities that children like, right? So that was research done a long time ago. There is no policy in Tusla, in the Department of Health, in the HSE, in the Department of Children, in the Department of Justice in relation to alcohol licensing law. There is no policy in relation to how we in this country run, manage and keep safe children who are attending underage events and licensed premises. And I think that's quite shocking. There was one reference in a national young people's recreational policy back in 2007, and that made a number of recommendations around safety and how safety would be managed at these events. But that policy was never resourced. It was never renewed. It was never evaluated. And the teenage disco somehow is like this blind spot in Irish policy. Mm-hmm. So what we're just saying to the minister is 20 years after Minister McDougall, you know, made amendments to the legislation, you now have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to close some of those loopholes and to take very seriously the protection of children.
So that an event would not...
I
don't want to put words in your mouth here, but you're suggesting that an event would not go ahead, be it at a regular nightclub or at a temporary venue like a GAA club or a community hall, wherever these things happen, that they would not go ahead without the provision of a safety centre, so to speak?
Without having a child safeguarding plan. So if I wanted to run, I'm thinking youth organisations run things like parties in the park in the summer or any of those things, you know, alcohol-free events. They have to have what's called a child safeguarding statement to say how they're going to manage children, how they're going to manage unsupervised children, unruly children, somebody who's injured, somebody who's in distress, somebody who's had something to happen to them. So what we're saying is just take those standards and apply them to this social space that children are, you know, really going to quite a lot. They're paying €20 a pop to go to these events. So it's €20 a pop. And if there's 2,000 people, there's a lot of money being made.
Yeah.
You know, there's an awful lot of money being made for a nighttime economy that's on its knees.
So would you expect people, organisers, for example, to have something like a safety statement, a safety mission statement? You could
absolutely.
You could run the gauntlet, Paula, and I'm not making the accusation, but you could run the gauntlet of being accused of a nanny state approach. Teenage years are rebellious years.
Yeah.
And you experiment and you do things you normally wouldn't, and you get. And I remember my teenage years. Now, I didn't drink until I was 17, but like your teen, and the more rules are put up there, the harder you work to try to break them.
Absolutely, it's your job as a teenager to push the boundaries, and it's our job as adults to hold a line. You know, we have people. Risk actually is a really fundamental part of growing up. So it's about developing independence, but also at a brain development level. Taking risks is really, it's a really important part of those teenage years. But you can't have risks that aren't managed. You can't have risks that you don't think about. So if I want to take somebody cliff jumping or jumping off piers, and I taught swimming and did things like that for years, you had to have a safety statement. You had to have a plan. What do you do if things go wrong?
You know how litigious people are in 2024, Paula. And I'm just going to throw a scenario at you here now. And I'm long enough around the block to know, don't rule it out. So you have a teenage disco and you have this safety space, safety room, safety mission, call it what you will. A young girl of 15 or 16 goes along to one of these events and she goes into the safety room and whatever. Or what happens? She gets assaulted outside, sexually assaulted, or she ends up, worse again, pregnant after one of these things. What's to stop a litigious parent coming back on the organisers and saying, you didn't protect my daughter?
Absolutely. But, you know, this is about taking a rational, reasoned and sensible approach to how we do this. So you never get rid of risk. You know, risk, I suppose, in managing an organisation, you think about, well, how
life
do you manage?
Life without risk would be a silly life. We all need to.
Yeah, but also we work. Yeah, but we work as a charity. We work with very vulnerable people. We work with people who have an alcohol-related brain injury. We work with families where there is, you know, breakdown in relationships, where there's family conflict, where there's family violence as a result of parental alcohol or other drug addiction. And everything we do, we have to think about, well, how do we manage risk? How do I have a lone worker going out into that home? What is my safety statement around that? What is my risk assessment around that? So I don't think anyone who has a license to sell alcohol has to go back into the court every September to renew that license and say, I am a fit person to be running this. I have run a good venue and I'm good of good character. What would be wrong with requiring people to say, well, actually, over the next 12 months, I'm going to run, you know, underage events and I'm going to make a very good profit on it. But here's the risk mitigation measures that I'm going to put in place.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything too much in that. And I think the minister should see that it's just really.
And lastly and briefly,
sensible.
Paula, it's a yes, no. You would like to see those safety procedures made mandatory.
I would.
Okay, leave it there. Thank you very much. That's interesting. Paula Leonard, CEO of the Alcohol Forum in Ireland, suggesting that teenage discos would not go ahead, be allowed to go ahead, be licensed, whatever they have to be, unless there is a mandatory provision of safety for youngsters who arrive drunk or who have an incident, or that you don't throw them out, for example, if they arrive drunk. You bring them into a safe room and call their parents or call the guards. She wants to make all of that mandatory.
Join the conversation.
This is the Opinion Line
with the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining, and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
Hi there, it's Ryan Tuberty here. Join me every Sunday morning at 10 on Cork's 96 FM.
Cork's 96 FM.
There's a mixture of chat, fun and the best music to kickstart your Sunday, so we'll talk to you then.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on Sunday, in association with Hyundai. For every kind of driver, there's a Hyundai. Find yours at Hyundai.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves,
feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The minds are live.
Hello.
Join the conversation.
Call 0818-969696.
Text or WhatsApp 083-396-9696.
Email opinion at 96fm.ie.
This is the Opinion Line with PJ Coogan.
Cork's 96FM.
Yeah, a bit of fun for you after 11 this morning, and people are messaging in again. 083-396-9696. A box set. If I had one to give you, which I don't, a box set of any show you like ever made that was ever on television. I just want to see the kind of stuff that our listeners would be into. D says Green Acres. I used to love Green Acres, D. Home Alone. Yeah, they're films rather than television shows, but we'll take it, Yvonne. Thank you. Glen Rowe, Bracken and the Reardons, says Margaret. Oh my goodness me, Phil. I didn't think there was anybody else in the world who remembered Marcus Welby, MD. I really didn't. I think it was probably the first medical... I watched loads of medical shows. I think it was my first ever time falling in love with a medical show. It was Marcus Welby, MD. Oh God, Phil, thank you. 0818-969696, the number, the text, or WhatsApp, 083-396-9696, and the email opinion at 96fm.ie. We were talking to Mike this morning. His daughter and her boyfriend were assaulted last Saturday night week in Carrigaline, and he's determined, and they're determined, to see it through to the end. He was talking about safety on the streets, and you know, there's not enough guards there. There's no blame to the guards. They've been brilliant for his daughter and her boyfriend, but there's not enough of them. And only for an active-minded bus driver on the night and a community-minded bus driver on the night, things might have been much worse. A driver on the 220 pulled up the bus, opened the door, locked the door, and rang the guards, letting the two young people into the bus, which was fantastic. And whoever did that on the 220 that night, take a bow. And if you're their boss, give him a bonus if you can. Mick was talking then, he's an Australian, and he was just pointing out how this kind of thing wouldn't have been tolerated in Australia. The cops would be on it like flies, and just chatting about, you know, the comparisons between the two. This isn't signed, but it draws a couple of things into the conversation. A lot of stuff towards cops isn't tolerated in Oz. For example, that disgraceful behaviour in Wicklow. Yes, those appalling scenes in Newtown Mount Kennedy last night. Real thuggery tackled by the guards on site. Only 6 arrests. There must have been 200 people there. There could have been 60. But at least only 6 arrests. Big long statement issued by the guard. Disgraceful scenes. Things being said like, if they're not Irish, we'll burn the place. Like, what kind of old nonsense is that? Anyway, well done. And I say, and I'll stand over it, I say well done to the guards for handling that situation last night in Newtown, Mount Kennedy. This message also brings up Mick Barry's adventures in the Dáil yesterday. You'll be aware that in the last couple of days, the DPP has determined that there will be no prosecution in the case of the death of George Enchenko. I'm not going to go into the details of that it is what it is. It's a case that's done and dusted. But the DPP in the last few days indicated that there will be no prosecution in that case. Mick Barry then went into the Dáil yesterday afternoon and spent 10 minutes battling back and forth with the Crown Corla, who eventually suspended the House because he just was not allowing Mick Barry to do what you're not supposed to do, blur the lines between, you know, separation of powers and all of that. And I was looking at the responses to Mick Barry. I was looking at Mick Barry's own responses. I don't know where you stand on it, but Mick knew. Mick knew. Mick Barry knew. He's long enough going into the Dáil. He knew the minute he went in yesterday with his notes that the DPP was going to shut him down. He knew why the DPP was going to shut him down. Anyway, and he kept going. He knew it'd be shut down. He knew why it'd be shut down, and he kept going. And that was the bit that I was looking at. I was actually watching the video, so Mick, for Christ's sake, you know you're not going to get this. Anyway. 0818 96 96 96. Right, back to Cork and crime in Cork and safety in Cork and how dangerous the streets of Cork have become. Stephen, you reckon that Cork was way safer back in the 80s. Morning.
Yeah. Good morning, PJ. I love the show. I was listening in there, and that's where that Australian guy's daughter was attacked, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I find that very frustrating. Like, I mean, two innocent people going about their business and out of nowhere, like,
yeah,
they get jumped, you know? And, like, for me, there was a time in Cork. I grew up in the 70s, 80s in Cork, like, and there was a time when you just wouldn't do things like that, number one, anyway, you know. You wouldn't just, you know, go along and jump people and you know what I mean? This is all as a result of drug abuse, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the other side of it then is that, you know, they know there's no consequences, you know. Even if the Gardaí caught up with them, you know, eventually, like.
Well, one of them was arrested, Stephen. Mick told us this, and we'll podcast it afterwards if people missed it. But one of them was arrested, and she was back out in the streets the following morning.
Back out in the street, exactly, doing the same thing, not a care in the world. There are people being given suspended sentences there, and they're going back in shoplifting the same day on the way home from the court. Like, I mean, it's totally out of control, like, you know. And like I said, back in the 80s, and the 70s, if you had the audacity to deal drugs on the street, you find yourself in the back of a van and taken for a spin somewhere, like, you know. I mean, we're tolerating, we're putting up too much. You know, I don't advocate vigilantism by any means.
No.
You know, but there's no deterrent. We have to do something, you know.
Mm.
We have to protect our citizens, and the citizens that are new to the country, I welcome them all. You know, people that are coming over here for work, you know, trying to have a better life for themselves. I welcome each and every one of them to Ireland, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it enriches us.
Yes.
My idea is something around the lines of this. what if we recruited volunteers who are trained, who are security people, who are recruit, you know, who are training as Gardaí or training as soldiers, you know, and raise some sort of funding around it so that they could back up the guards and just be present until the guards can make it to the scene, you know.
Like a community force sort of thing.
Yeah, sort of, like, yes, like a night watch kind of a thing, you know, where we could, you know, when I say we, you know, I'd include myself, like, but I mean, people could patrol the streets and you have a hotline, right? So you get a buzz, something's happening on Oliver Plunkett Street. You take a walk down there. You're not going down there looking for a fight or to beat anybody up. You're going down there to be a presence, you know?
Neighbourhood watch.
You know, exactly, you know? And people could wear these alarms, you know, that you could press a button if you're in trouble. It gets through to the hotline. Your location is identified. And the patrol makes their way down there. Like, it happens in other countries, and it works in other countries, you know.
Yeah, like that situation that occurred in Carrigaline, where, okay, the guards came now, to be fair, because people rang, but they're so far away, they have to come practically from Toker, and only for a bus driver going above and beyond the call of duty. Who knows what we'd have been talking about?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, Tolka Barracks covers an enormous area. Like, I mean, you're talking about Cargilline, you're talking about Ringiskiddy, you're talking about, and the other side, you're going all about the Bandon at night.
I said this before, and I said it again. The barracks, the Garda barracks in Carrigaline, the place where I lived for 10 years and still love it to this day. It's an ornament.
They
might as well close it down and open a sweet shop.
Same one in Douglas, by the finger post round.
One that the FBI would be proud of. I pass it every day. It's a dead zone.
They might as well put migrants in there and use it as that, you know, use it for that. But it's not a Garda station any longer.
Yeah, there's a few guards in there, in and out, doing a bit of paperwork, and it's open. The public office is open from time to time. But I'm living in Douglas pretty much all my life, and I'm living up the road from that Garda station for the last 20 years. I don't know when it's open.
Yeah, yeah. Crazy. You never see it open. Like, I mean, if you were attacked outside that Garda station, you couldn't be in a worse place.
Mm.
I'm telling you, by the way, Stephen,
I hope we're on the same page here. I'm not blaming the guards for this.
No, not. Look, I think they do an amazing job for it. Like, they're understaffed.
We're 120. I have the figure from the GRA. The figure from the GRA, from the Garda Representatives Association. They tell me that at any one time since about 2022, we are 120 guards short in Cork.
There you are. I mean, it's Ireland's second city, like, you know, and growing all the time, you know, population is growing all the time. I mean, for me, they're tied up in court an awful lot, you know, a lot of paperwork involved. And these patrols that I'm talking about, if they were trained in writing a report, maybe, you know, somebody back at the, you know, and I'm talking about, like, as I said, like, not vigilantism, but, you know, a night watch. You know, I don't. They have them in the States. There are some. What do they call them there?
I know what you mean. Just watch. Just community watch and keep. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's all you're doing.
There was a reserve guard force. I don't know whatever happened to the reserve guard's force, but that was supposed to be there, but it was kind of too.
It kind of dwindled. Yeah,
but Stephen, you maintain anyway. I'll leave it there. Thank you. But you maintain that Cork in the 80s, and in my time, Cork in the 90s, because I was out DJing 3-4 nights a week in the 90s, and Cork, Stephen maintains, was far safer back then, and far safer back in the 80s. I'm a little bit young to remember being out in the street in the 80s, but. He remembers it being far safer, and certainly in the 90s. I agree with on the 90s. There was always danger out there, but it was nothing like it is now. Nothing. 0818 96 96 96. Let me do this first before I go to the break. Lillian rang yesterday, and you can catch it on podcast if you want to. Lillian went to renew her television license, and she hadn't paid it last year because she said she couldn't afford it. So she went down to the end of March. She paid in her post office for the license. Now she discovers she needs to pay again because she didn't pay last year, and the whole thing has to be backdated. She didn't know that. I didn't know that. Nobody in the post office, when she went down to pay it, told her that. Maybe that's not their job. But Barry, Fergal, in fairness, went and did some legwork on it yesterday afternoon, got on Post and got a statement from Angus Laverty. Now, on Post collect the television license, so he went directly to the official source, and the simple answer from Mr. Laverty is that yes, the television license must be backdated. A person who is simply late in renewing their license have to pay also for the period they didn't have a license. He was kind enough to attach the relevant section of the legislation, which is section 2 of the Television Licenses Regulation 2007, etc. etc. I didn't know that till yesterday. Did you know that? You have to backdate your television license.
Join the conversation.
This is the Opinion Line.
With the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
Hey, it's Al Gibbs.
Welcome.
Join me this coming Friday night on Cork's 96 FM for the multi-award winning Freaks on Friday.
Are you with me?
60 minutes of the most unbelievable remixes ever made. The very best in electronic music, dance, house, techno, disco and more.
Listen to the sound.
Check it out every single Friday night, 8 o'clock on Cork's 96 FM.
I know you feel it.
Cork's 96 FM's Freaks with Al Gibbs.
Now this time last week we were digesting the unlawful killing verdict from the Stardust inquest. All 48 people who died that night. In fact, 49. The number is now 49 because one of the victims was pregnant. 49 people who died that night were unlawfully killed. That was the verdict of the Stardust inquest. There's a podcast has dropped in the last 24 hours and will go on for 7 or 8 weeks that I think we all need to hear.
I suddenly realised, I remember saying, Michael is not coming home. I couldn't go to the door dead, but I knew Michael wasn't coming home.
In the early hours of February the 14th, 1981, 48 young people died when fire engulfed the Stardust nightclub in Artain, Dublin.
He said, place is on fire, we're not going to get everybody out. Tell the officer to send absolutely everything that you have.
Nobody saw it coming. If they did, it was already too late.
Just people were screaming outside. You could hear them screaming.
846 people came through the doors that night. 44 would never come out. 4 more died in hospital. It was one of Ireland's most catastrophic tragedies.
And then everything went black and everybody started squealing and roaring and you could see the flames, do you know what I mean? And everybody then, it was just like wild animals.
Getting out was a lottery.
There was a state play and bars on the window, so we couldn't get out.
Only fate decided who lived and who died. Those who escaped and those left behind were doomed to forever live in the suffocating shadow of Stardust. For some survivors, they never really got out. And for the families left behind, their souls were taken with their kids inside that building.
Those that got out of the building got out of hell, but we've lived in hell.
They were left at the mercy of an uncaring state.
I want to know why the state interfered. I want questions answered.
The families vowed to battle for justice.
This is the story of the Stardust tragedy.
Brought to you by the Irish Sun.
That's the voice of Damien Lane, the narrator of this podcast, and a man who's done a heck of a lot of research into it over the last number of years. Damien, I was reminding listeners last week of my own memories being a young, very lazy teenager, lying at home in my bed, wanting to wake up to watch the telly, and then this story's on the news. And it only occurred to me as I read more and more and more over the last days in between, at the age I was at the time, and had I been in Dublin, I could have been in there. Morning.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the Stardust was the mecca for people around North Dublin, the working class people of North Dublin. You know, who, they worked hard all week and they scraped together a few bob to go to the disco, and the Stardust was the place to go. So everybody who was anybody was in the Stardust in the years that preceded the fire. You know, so it was kind of it was an iconic place, a place where everybody went on a Friday and Saturday night. And this Friday night, this Friday the 13th, Valentine's weekend disco, for want of a better word, was packed out. More than 800 punters in there, some as young as 14. Yeah. So it was a place that people went. I mean, the likes of Dickie Rock played there, Ian Jury and the Blockheads, mm-hmm. The Specials, people might remember them. Joe Dolan. So it was the place to be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How far back does your own interest in it as a journalist go?
Well, it goes back right to the beginning, really. I mean, I was 11 years of age in 1981, PJ, probably slightly younger than yourself, but I remember it. I remember the Stardust then vividly. I mean, it was my kind of coming of age as a kind of a very young child, you know, a political coming of age as well. I mean, the story of the Stardust, you know, has been 43 years in the making. But it's really a story that encapsulates all that was wrong with Ireland in the 1980s, you know. Mm. Tragedy, I mean, it was a tragic night, but it was how an uncaring state really treated those who had nothing. The families and the survivors, they really had nothing. And they relied on the state in the aftermath of the fire to stand up and do its job, and it didn't.
Is it fair really to say, Damien, as an analysis, and like many of us, I've read more probably in the last week than I had done in the intervening years before it.
True.
It was a state that tried to make it go away.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, you couldn't hit the nail more on the head. I mean, we're talking about Charlie Haughey's Ireland. And for those who didn't live in the 1980s, you know, it was a place where kind of it wasn't the utopia the kids of today think it is. You know, I mean, far from it. It was especially if you're working class, there were pretty miserable times. You know, finding work was almost impossible. You know, hundreds of thousands of people emigrated because they had to. Those that stayed behind kind of lived in a place which was riddled really with political corruption. Dreadful public services. You know, the Catholic Church were still kind of kings of the land, for want of a better word. There was crippling inflation, grinding poverty. So that's the Ireland of the 1980s from where the Stardust kind of emerged, really. And the story of the Stardust is kind of the story of the 1980s.
It was Charlie Haughey's constituency, wasn't it?
It was. Dublin Central. Dublin North Central was his constituency, yeah. But I mean, if you look at what happened in the aftermath of the tragedy itself, within 3 days, Charlie had set up a tribunal of inquiry. Why so quickly? I mean, the cause of the fire, you know, those, apart from the inquests which happened a year later, which were, how should I say, perfunctory, would be an apt word. They too lasted 3 days. I mean, those inquests, the jury were instructed to concentrate solely on how the 48 victims died. They weren't allowed to explore the cause of the fire, to attribute blame, nothing. So it was a sham, for want of a better word. Then the tribunal of inquiry, which was set up by Mr. Haughey, you know, that heaped further pain on the victims' families and the survivors, because it eventually arrived at a conclusion after 122 days of evidence, without any evidence of it whatsoever, that somebody inside that building that night set fire to it.
They tried to blame the kids. They tried to blame the kids, Damien.
They didn't try to blame the kids. They blamed the kids. Yeah. They said it was probably arson, somebody messing with matches, somebody lighting a newspaper on a seat. But that wasn't the case at all. So the inquests for 3 days were a sham. The tribunal that lasted for 122 days branded them as criminals. And the families were told to go away. I mean, one of the women we speak to, Gertrude Barrett, who lost her son, Michael, he was a DJ on the night.
That's right.
He didn't want to go to the... He didn't want to go to the disco that night. He said to his mum, I'm worried about the electrics. The electrics are always overloaded. But he went anyway.
Yeah. The DJ knows the electrics, trust me, when I tell you.
Well, there you go. Yeah, absolutely. You know better than I do. But he died that night, you know. You know, it's a story of betrayal of an entire community. Because they were poor, because they could be kind of pushed to one side. We don't want you anymore. Gertrude was given a body bag with the number 38 in it, she told us, and told to just leave us alone. We don't want you anymore. But she said to us in the podcast, there's no way I'm going to let my son die like that. And she spent the last 43 years, along with the other families and survivors, fighting for justice. It took them 43 years, PJ.
I know. And I was sitting listening to Joe Duffy, because in fairness, Joe's programme went live into the outcome of the inquest. I say one thing, Damien, I don't know if you know her, but Myra Cullinan used to be the coroner here in Cork. And as a journalist myself, as a journalist myself and a court reporter, I sat in many, many of her inquests. And the minute I saw her name attached to this one, I said, if anybody can get to the truth, it's Dr. Cullinan.
Absolutely thorough, impeccable and pristine in everything she ever did. And she delivered an inquest 42 years too late, but she delivered a public forum for the truth to emerge finally from the pall of smoke that hovered really over the North Inner City for so long, you know.
Here's a typical story, actually, one of the most harrowing, Damien, like Bridget McDermott. She lost three children. She doesn't even remember, even now, she doesn't even remember burying them. William was 22, George was 19, Marcella was 16. She told her dad she was babysitting but snuck off to the club. Sure, what teenager hasn't done that? And Bridget McDermott's marriage broke down as well as a result of the tragedy. That's a family utterly destroyed. And you'll note, Damien, I know that the preview there says 48. You'll note now that the official figure is up to 49 because one of the women was pregnant.
Yeah, indeed. She was pregnant that night. I mean, all of the stories are so unique, but in a way, they're all the same in that the stories are one of incredible loss, but then of an insult that was attached to each of those losses that persisted for so long and was allowed to persist for so long. I think the fact that it was allowed to persist for so long is kind of what's more damaging and soul-destroying than anything else. Why did it take 43 years for this to be kind of turned on its head?
Well, the late, great Charlie Board would have told you it's because of where they came from.
Well, there's an element of that, absolutely. But if you consider that Charles J. High, the man who liked to ride a horse, the man who told us in 1980, it's time to tighten your belts, folks. Well, he was off swanning away in fancy restaurants and wearing chaves, silk ties and wining and dining and having bank loans written off. I mean, he was the guy in charge. He was the guy that kind of basically...
It happened in his constituency. It happened in his constituency. And he tried to make it go away. He did his level best to make it go away. And actually, there's a great book written. Gary Murphy wrote a biography of Charlie Haughey, and this is touched on in the book. It's a big tome of a book, but it's worth a read. The podcast has dropped on Spotify or Apple, wherever you get your stuff. The first episode is out. One question for you, Damien. Now that the verdicts of unlawful killing have been reached, there is the possibility that this will go back to the Gardaí. Do you touch on that in the podcast?
We do. I mean, obviously, when we were researching and writing it and producing it, obviously the unlawful killing verdicts hadn't dropped, but they've dropped now, and that will form a very, very good chunk of the final episodes in the podcast. I mean, essentially, Commissioner Drew Harris has ordered the cold case unit to begin an investigation into Maura Cullinan's, the coroner's file from the inquest. And that's something the families really need for complete closure. The unlawful killing verdicts last week were one step. The state apology that happened on Tuesday, Simon Harris's heartfelt apology in the Dáil, was another step. But it's not enough. more needs to be done. One of the things actually that needs to be done immediately is a proper redress scheme, financial redress scheme for the survivors and the families.
Mm-hmm.
If you can take yourself back to 1985, three years after the tribunal report and 3 years after the inquests, they approached the families with take it or leave it compensation offers as low as £7,500, the equivalent of 40,000 in today's money.
Mm.
And if you consider that because of the tribunal report, which said that the cause of the fire was probable arson, the guys who owned or leased the Stardust, the Butterley family, sued Dublin Corporation for criminal damage and were awarded £561,000 in compensation.
As Christy Moore refers to in that wonderful song.
Yes, and the only guy who was ever brought to justice for what happened in the Stardust was Christy Moore for singing that song.
That's right. That's right. You're right. It ended up.
So proper redress is the next step for the state to take, proper financial redress. And then the final hurdle that the families want crossed is for there to be a proper Garda investigation into what happened that night. And if there's any culpability, for that to happen in the courts and to be, for justice to finally be done.
Do you think?
So we're only halfway there.
You're doing this a long time and you've worked hard on this podcast and I look so forward to listening to it, particularly the post-inquest episodes of it. Do you think there is any possibility that anybody will ever, and I'm not naming anybody or suggesting anybody's name here, do you think there's ever a possibility, Damien Lane, that anybody will sit in a box in a court to face charges here?
Well, as being someone who grew up in the 1980s and knows how Ireland works and has been a journalist for nearly 30 years now, and no more than yourself, there's, we have a kind of a jaundiced eye on how the machinery, the state, clicks. I doubt it very much, PJ. I hope I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I hope for the family's sakes and for the sake of the survivors who have lived with the scars of that night for all their lives, I hope that somebody or some institution or whatever it is brought to justice, and the families and the survivors can finally close the book and achieve some kind of catharsis. You know, can you imagine kind of waking up every day and the first thought in your mind is for your child who died that night?
My child was killed. My child was unlawfully killed that night.
Unlawfully killed that night, yeah.
That's what I'd think as a father, and I am a father. I don't know if you are.
Yeah, I am. I have two sons, correct, and they're in their 20s.
If I woke up every morning,
thank God.
If I had to wake up every morning thinking that either of my children had been unlawfully killed, I wouldn't rest until I put their killer behind bars.
Well, you couldn't. You couldn't. I mean, and so it's not only is it a necessity that justice be done in the courts. The state really and the institutions of the state have a moral responsibility to ensure that it happens, because you know how can they leave a verdict like that alone. They can't. So it's good news that the Gardaí and Drew Harris has ordered his best detectives in the cold case unit to take this on, because they will go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and anything that they can stick their claws into, get their teeth into, they will. And it may take time, but it won't take 43 years. And the families and the survivors are willing to wait. They've waited so long now, they're willing to wait that extra bit to finally achieve closure, you know.
All right. Listen, the first episode of the podcast has dropped. It'll be dropping weekly on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcast. It's simply called the Stardust Tragedy Podcast. I look forward to listening to it. And go and read it. If you're a bit young and you're not quite sure of the size of the story we're talking about, go and read it up. Just look up the Stardust Tragedy. Look up Stardust Tragedy pen pictures. It was one of the most stunning things they did, Dr. Cullinan, at the inquest. Damien, thank you. The coroner, Dr. Cullinan, got each of the parents, each of the families, to draw up a little pen picture of the people who were unlawfully killed. In fact, I think from this moment forward, I will never again say the people who died in the Stardust. I will say the people who were unlawfully killed on that night in 1981. Read those pen pictures. If you did nothing else this weekend, if you want to familiarise yourself, if you're a bit young, you don't fully understand the gravity of this. This was one of the biggest stories of my childhood. This is one of the biggest news stories of my childhood, my teenage years. And it's still open, and it's still ongoing. Thank you, Damien.
Join the conversation.
This is the Opinion Line.
With the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
Cork's 96 FM's Take Me to Taylor.
You guys are incredible. This is so fun.
Listen to Be Our VIP.
Give it up for Taylor Swift. You ready?
You could be going to see Taylor Swift live in Wembley.
Live in Wembley.
Always rooting for the anti-hero.
We want to send you and a friend on the ultimate VIP experience.
Two nights in London with flights,
hotel,
spending money,
and VIP tickets to Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour, August 17th.
Shake it off, shake it off.
Listen for the hits of Tay-Tay from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. weekdays for your chance to win.
Your chance to win. Take Me to Taylor.
With Bridgestone and Desi's Tyres. Open 7 days. Desi'sTyres.ie.
Only on Cork's 96 FM.
Yeah, can I just mention the very, very best of luck to my dear old friend, Dave O'Connor. He opens the new store, Suits.ie, in Paul Street. Paul Street tomorrow. This is Suits Distributors' latest venture, Suits.ie. They're in Paul Street, across from Tesco. And he's introducing a wedding lounge. And I know Dave has been talking about this for ages. He wants to do a special wedding lounge for his suit outlets. Best luck to Dave and all the staff at Suits Distributors. Well done, fellas. I know you've been working so hard on getting into that centre, and well done to you. Time for this week's episode of Hours to Protect. Moraid has been looking at a compostable apron for people who need to wear PPE.
Hours to Protect, brought to you by Cork's 96 FM, the IBI, and funded by Commission na Mban with the television licence fee. Check out hourstoprotect.ie for more info.
This week on Hours to Protect, we meet the Cork cousins behind a compostable PPE apron who are now working on rolling out pilots of their world first on-site medicalised biodigester. Dr. Mary O'Riordan and Lisa O'Riordan come from different professional backgrounds and they've merged their skill sets to create Happy Earths.
We thought at the beginning, oh look, let's do a compostable apron product, brilliant, done and dusted. And here we are now actually looking at waste streams and dashboards and biodigestion, and it's certainly, you never, but that's the journey of life. I think you actually just go with it. If you're truly passionate about solving something, you really have to keep going, and regardless of the obstacles and the, you know, the challenges.
That's it. And even for our family, it's lovely. You know, our parents meet up every Wednesday night and they're living through the whole story of how are you getting on now and who did you meet and what happened.
Lisa and Mary met after COVID, and that's where the Happy Earth journey started, as Lisa has been telling us.
We met in my garden. It was just one of those things where we were chatting away, just saying, God, what's the new normal going to be like now? And I said, Mary, isn't it crazy? Like, you know, it's so much, you know, single-use plastic PPE going on now. How come it's not compostable at this point? And she was like, Lisa, it's been on my mind in the same way, you know.
The Happy Apron was a winner of the Health Innovation Hub Ireland Open Call 2022. Mary says the support has been so important.
We had a fantastic opportunity with Health Innovation Hub Ireland, Tanya and all of the crew there, to actually introduce our product, which was the single-use splash apron, and that was the simplest product in our range because it really was not changing anything about the pattern. And we felt this thing, there were millions of them being used, and they're really throwaway items that cannot be reused or recycled. So we knew that this low-density polyethylene plastic was just never going to have a recycling outcome. So we said, let's, as Lisa said, convert it over to a compostable alternative.
Mary says feedback from healthcare workers has been vital.
For us, the real light bulb moment came from the healthcare workers themselves. It was like, we love it, it's brilliant, but if we incinerate these compostable products, it doesn't really get the value out of them. So what's the point? And it isn't that they were being negative about it. They were just really pointing out that this is a wonderful product here. What, then it's almost a shame that it goes out into incineration, you know. So that's when we said, okay, let's really go back to the drawing board and see, can we look at a full cycle circular model for circular economy purposes? And if you design a product from the start, you must be really mindful about where the end of that life cycle is. And that's what we kind of wanted to change also about how we view these things. So if you design something, you must bear in mind where it goes. And that's every product on the planet, I think. We're really interested in people thinking like that. So we created a compostable bioresin product that was fully CE approved. And we said, where can it go then? And we looked at other waste streams in the hospital sector, and the other was food waste, massive problem for healthcare because you always have to feed patients and they're not always well enough to eat the full amount. So you will have an element of food waste. So we said, why don't we look at putting two really challenging waste streams together? And we took the compostable PPE with hospital food waste, put it into what we call an on-site medicalized biodigester, which is on-site where you actually, and we've created it so that it can deal with healthcare waste streams. So that will then be converted into a pathogen-safe fertilizer. And that then means you can use it for horticulture, or you could use it as a precursor for anaerobic digestion and biomethane production.
The medicalized biodigester will be piloted soon with the dashboard to track its impact in each setting, as Lisa explains.
We know that certainly in the healthcare sector, they're extremely busy with the processes that they're doing anyway, you know, so we are basically trying to help them with their journey to sustainability. And we feel that any element, like there's lots of plastic items that can't be converted over, but anything that can, like their plastic aprons, their cups, their, you know, cutlery, anything that we feel that are legitimately compostable, that they would be able to run through our cycle. And then in return, it just means that they will, we would have this dashboard for them. It's like this, you know, dashboard that can essentially say to them, okay, look how much you've reduced your plastics. Look how much when you've converted over, you've reduced your carbon emissions.
While the pilot is taking place here, there is interest from overseas.
Because it's quite a complicated thing that we're trying to do, right? It's, in our eyes, it's not, but like when you're trying to explain it to people. So I think once there's one on the ground, we'll be able to, you know, bring other healthcare providers down to take a look at it, and then internationally as well. Like there's already interest in the UK and in the States, so it's very exciting.
To find out more about Happy Earth, you can visit happyearth.ie or check the show notes of this episode.
Ours to Protect, brought to you by Cork's 96 FM, the IBI, and funded by Commission na Mban with the television licence fee. Check out ourstoprotect.ie for more info.
Thank you more, Ed, and another episode of Ours to Protect back at the same time next week.
Join the conversation.
This is The Opinion Line.
With the Furniture Centre, Watercourse Road, Blackpool. For sofas, beds, kitchen, dining and mattresses. Over 45 years in business. TheFurnitureCentre.ie.
Cork's 96 FM.
Back to something we were talking about during the week. Miko was on. He was talking about road safety. And Miko's first language isn't English, but he made a super point. We're talking about road safety in Ireland, and his belief is that people are still learning how to drive from their dad or their cousin or their uncle or their friend or their classmate. That they're taking them out and they're putting them into a car and saying, stay between the ditches and don't hit anything. And that's the way a lot of us learned to drive back in the day. But Darren was listening. Darren runs a driving school and has been teaching driving now for many a long day. Darren, you have some thoughts on that, I think. Morning.
I'd like to expand on the point. Like,
to be fair, the ones that are getting the driving practice in between are the lucky ones.
Yeah.
The biggest problem that we face in the industry is parents think, oh, I'll pay the 12 lessons and when you pass your test, I'll get you insured. But like, they need to be insured and they need to be practicing in between the lessons in order to pass the test. Like, I always say to parents when they're sitting in with learner drivers, just be there as a second set of eyes. A lot of the time when parents over-instruct, like, for example, when they're coming up to busy junctions and mum or dad is saying, stop, you can go now, it's safe to go. Then when they go out to do the driving test, they can't think for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a big failure. Like, when a driving examiner is doing a test, they're basically examining that you can actually make independent decisions on your own. And if you can't make independent decisions on your own, therefore, when they pass you, they're allowing you to drive unaccompanied.
It's the most natural thing in the world, because I sat next to my daughter Sunday morning after Sunday morning as she learned to drive. It's the most natural thing in the world to egg them on and say, watch this fellow come out your left or keep an eye to the right there. You're actually doing them no favours.
No favours whatsoever. I'm always telling parents, all you're there to do is to say stop if required. In the sense of, leave the driving instructor do the work and leave them build up the driving practice and experience in between. Only be there to catch them when they're going to fall. Like they stall at a set of traffic lights, leave them stall.
Yeah.
Leave them nice and relaxed, don't mind the car behind them.
Yeah.
And leave them take their time. Look, to be totally honest about it, 95% of the motorists on the road give the learner driver a break.
Do they though, I wonder? Do they?
Generally, yes. Generally, yes. A lot of people would overtake us. I've never really had a very bad road rage incident with someone. But, like, generally, yes.
In terms of what you have to do, maybe clarify this one for me, Darren. Do they have to do their 12 now before they will be accepted for their test? Or can you still learn with Dad?
You have to do the 12 mandatory lessons, but you only have to do it once.
Yeah.
It would be no harm if they brought out a system. I wouldn't expect them to up to 12 lessons, because I think the 12 lessons really work if it's done correctly. If they were getting the driving practice in between, the 12 lessons would really work. But the one thing that I would like to see coming in is, if they fail a driving exam, there should be more mandatory lessons, even a small number, 2, 3, or 4 lessons, you know, every time they fail a test. We have people that are on 20 tests plus, getting learner permits all their life. Like, there should be mandatory driving lessons for people that fail a driving test. No, I'm not saying a huge number, maybe 2 or 3, you know.
The cynics out there will say, Darren, you would say that, wouldn't you? And you making a few quid out of it. But no, the point is valid. And you're saying, I went on this last week, there are people out there driving on their 8th, 9th, and 10th learner permit, and they fail test after test. I was asking this of another instructor last week. Is it time to ask them, come here, do you really think you're cut out for this driving, Larker? Should you take the bus?
To be honest about it, PJ, from my experience, down through the years, I've had a lot of people, they just don't bother. They just don't put in the effort. They just, like, I've had people that I've sat down with that have been on learner permits for 20 years and they throw in the towel and they say, right, let's do this. And they generally pass. Now, there is also people out there that would have nervous issues and they would panic and they might have medical conditions that aren't aware that there's actually a system in place for a supervised test.
Is there?
Like, oh, absolutely. If you had autism or ADHD or dyslexia, dyspraxia or anything like that, you can put a letter into the RSA and you'd be tested by a supervisor that would understand your medical condition.
Because a lot of people would contact me there from time to time and they'd say, Asher, PJ, my daughter, she has anxiety and the poor girl was all wound up getting into the car with the instructor. There has to be a better way, or with the tester. There has to be a better way. Is there?
There is. There is a better way, and it's in place all the time. But you have to have a letter from a medical professional.
Mm.
Like, you can't be just chancing your arm saying, oh, I have a medical condition. But, like, I get people, like, autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia. And once they have a diagnosis, they provide a medical evidence to the RSA. the examiner then would be a supervised examiner. The test would be the same test, but it would be very less formal.
I see.
But, like, obviously the same standard of driving would be expected out of you. But it would be very less formal, and the tester in that would be a testing. You would understand your condition.
So the test is designed to take account of your anxiety or your neurodivergence or whatever.
Exactly. The driving examiner that comes in for an ordinary applicant knows nothing about your medical condition.
I have you. Just in general, Darren, we really are in a distressing point of time with 65 or 66 people now dead on the roads. It must worry people like you who teach driving.
It does. I'm going to be honest about it, right? Everybody says, oh, you can't drive on your own, your car will be taken off you. PJ, I've students driving on their own constantly, driving up to the test centre, driving home, driving on L plates, taking down the L plates before lessons, sticking them on. None of them are having their gas taken off them.
Yeah.
It seems to be, they seem to do a blitz of it once a week, once a year. There was a checkpoint down from the driving test centre, they had one car taken there. Mm. And, the same with drink driving, PJ, I don't drink.
Right.
But I'm out 3 nights a week. I enjoy my life, my kids are nearly reared, but I don't drink, so I always have the car with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been stopped at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on breath lift. Yeah. Ever. I'm out long weekends and everything. I don't know when last I've been stopped in a checkpoint on breath test after coming out of the pub.
Mm. We hear of a resurgence in drink driving, and by the Minister for Justice in studio here with me only last week, and she was pointing to this new regime of every guard's going to do half an hour traffic policing in the course of their shift. And then you have the GRA telling us, sure, our traffic corps is half the size it was 10 years ago.
But see, the problem that I find there, right, is you have traffic corps and you have Gardaí, right? We just say I'm an honorary guard, and my job is to investigate crime and fight crime. And you're a local resident and you're coming down the road, and I stick out my hand and I say, PJ, you're 10k over the limit, you're getting 3 points for that now.
Mm.
I lose respect then as a guard in my community. Whereas at least if you have the traffic corps, they're not from, like, the local police. I don't think the local police enforcing traffic is going to go down well with the community they live in.
Yeah. Plus, as the GRA were also saying here, it's going to delay the lady who's had her house broken into from getting a response.
And, like, at least traffic police, like, they're going to local villages, they're in there for a half an hour doing a blitz and they're gone. They don't have to deal with the people for the next 20 years.
As we said, nearly 70 people dead, and it's only the end of April.
It is terrifying. It is terrifying. And, you know, like, the sad thing about it is it can all be prevented. Like, PJ, I do dangerous driving court reports. I specialise in that area, right?
Mm.
And, like, from my experience, drink driving is an older person's offence. Like, the vast majority of young people won't do it. But, like, drink driving seems to be, like, 50s plus, you know? It seems to be the older generation, but speed then seems to be killing the younger generation.
Something has to be done about it, and quickly. We have to come up with some solution to stop people dying. Darren, good talking to you. I know the conversation broadened out a bit, but thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers, Darren, for that. And again, the thoughts of people like Darren, very important to us as we try to see what it is we could do to maybe stop the carnage on our roads. We're now damn near to 70. Coming into another weekend, it could well be 70 by the time we're back here on Monday. And that is sad, and that is frightening. Pat was out for a walk during the week and got in touch with me because of it. And Pat, you're a bit concerned, I think, about graveyards and people bringing their dogs into graveyards. And you wanted to bring it up with me. Good morning.
Good morning, PJ.
This is out in St. Finbar's Cemetery. Dogs fouling the graves.
Yes, dogs fouling the graves. Dogs being left loose in the cemetery by their owners, PJ. And I've approached a few of them and I've asked them why their dogs haven't been on leashes, because I've seen them taking the dogs out of cars in the front of the cemeteries and leaving them loose in the cemeteries, and they are falling in the graves. They have no control once the dog is loose. Mm. And I've got abuse off of quite a few of these people, they said like that they don't seem to be objecting.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And I find it really shocking, because I have people buried there myself, and I have complained to the office there, and they tell me like that their hands are tied, and they have spoken to people in the past, and they're not getting, you know, much change out of them.
Mm. Is there a rule about dogs in the cemetery? You can take a dog in.
Yes, there is a sign there stating that you must have the dog on a lead in the cemetery at all times. And there's a sign, the sign says about no fouling as well in the cemetery. That obviously can be followed if the dog is loose.
Well, if you're with the dog and you're carrying poop bags, then you go and you pick it up. But the dog should be on a lead.
Yes, at all times. And there are big dogs and small dogs that's loose in the cemetery. And as I said, the owners seem to be taking them out of cars outside the cemetery and leave them run loose in the cemetery as if it was some sort of a playground.
Oh, so they're coming to the cemetery to walk the dog?
Yes.
And let the dog off the lead as you might do out in an open field in the country?
Yes. Now, whether they are people buried there or not, I'm not sure. But if they do have, it would show that they have very little respect for others that might have people buried there, because there is people there that look after their graves very well.
Yes, yes.
And I'm sure there's others there that don't have anyone still alive looking after their graves. The graves seem to be desecrated by the dogs. Now, the dog doesn't have any knowledge of what the dog is doing.
Yeah.
The dog can tell a grave from anything else.
I think it's particularly disrespectful, Pat, if you have nobody in that graveyard and you've no business to be there other than to let the dog run around. I think that's particularly disrespectful. Would you agree with me?
Yes, and no, I can't speak for the rest of the cemeteries. I've been in St. Catherine's because people buried belong to me in St. Catherine's. I've never seen it happen in St. Catherine's in the north side, but certainly I've seen it happen in St. Finbar's.
I know that you said you went to the office there and the lads there kind of said, look, the best will in the world, there's not a whole lot we can do. People tell us to F off, like they did you. The graveyard is run by the council. Have you tried contacting City Hall?
They are responsible if a dog will bite you in the cemetery, Peter.
Mm.
So I think they either marshal it better, or maybe do away with dogs in the cemetery altogether, and that will punish the innocent along with the guilty, unfortunately.
Well, there's a thing. You'd have to wonder, is a cemetery any place to be walking your dog, let alone letting them off the lead to run around?
Well, I suppose there's people there, maybe elderly people that bring the dog there, and maybe their partner or their husband or wife or whatever, maybe.
Visiting the grave is part of their day when they're out with the little dog. I see your point. I see your point.
Yes, for sure. And that would be the last resort, in my opinion. But the whole fact about it, I've seen it happen very frequently in the last year. I think it needs to be stopped.
That people just let their dogs loose in the graveyard.
Yes.
And if the dog does business, they're not picking it up, which is worse again.
No, and a dog will roost, as you know. A dog will roost. You've seen dogs yourself. And I mean, I'm not anti-dog or anti-animal law at all, so don't get me wrong.
No,
It's not a place for dogs to be left run wild. I mean, I spoke to a guy last week there, and he was, you know, couldn't care less attitude. What he said to me is that they don't care.
What a thing to say.
That's exactly what he said, Peter.
What a ridiculous thing to say, though.
Yeah.
Fairness, like, the dead don't care.
See, what's going to happen, Peter, is that there's going to be 50 cups outside, or somebody's going to take my offence to it. And
well, we'd certainly hope that you won't be involved in any of that.
You know, people can lose their head very quickly if things go wrong, and, you know, unless the things have happened. And
Pat, we'll see what people think. Personally, I'm with you. Dog in a graveyard only on a lead. And I'll go further. I don't know if you agree with me here. If you've nobody in that graveyard and you've no business to be there, then stay out of it with the dog.
Yeah, there's plenty of green fields still there, PJ, and if they're bringing, I've noticed that they're bringing the dogs along in cars. You know, I don't mind people walking the dogs there as long as they're under control. And you can't have a dog under control if the dog is loose.
Pat, have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Pat. There's the thing. If you have no business in a graveyard, it is not a place to walk your dog. How would you feel about dogs being banned out of graveyards? I think that's Pat, where Pat thinks